It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Central Time travels to outer space. We'll talk about some of the year's top astronomy news stories with Bill Andrews from Discover Magazine. First, President-elect Donald Trump has been at odds with the CIA since this weekend. The intelligence agency said that it had concluded with high confidence that Russians hacked into Democratic Party computers and then shared that information in order to help Trump win the election. On Friday evening, the Trump transition team issued a statement casting doubt on the CIA and its conclusions, saying that, quote, these are the same people that said Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. But other members of the GOP have joined bipartisan calls for an independent congressional investigation into the objectives of the hacking. That includes senators from different sides of the aisle, like Senators John McCain and Chuck Schumer, who both spoke on the CBS show this morning earlier today. Here's what McCain had to say.
There's no doubt about the hacking. Let's establish that. I was hacked into. My campaign in 2008 was hacked into. So there's no doubt about the hacking. Then the question is about the intention. But it's all part of the larger issue of the cyber threat we face from Russia, China, and other countries. It's another form of warfare, and the entire issue is going to be examined by the Armed Services Committee because it's a threat to our national security.
Alana Shore joins us now to talk more about the war of words between Congress and the president-elect. She's a congressional reporter for Politico. Alana, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We'll talk about what we're hearing from people, especially in the Senate, both sides of the aisle. What kind of investigation are they looking for here?
Well, what we're likely to see based on today's events is a Senate committee investigation through the regular channels. That means the Armed Services Committee, the Foreign Relations Committee, and the Select Intelligence Committee. What we probably won't see is what we call in Washington a select committee, so kind of a special group of lawmakers convened for a single purpose, like what we saw on the Benghazi issue.
What do we know about what the CIA had to say? This information that they're now saying it looks like the Russians were hacking in hopes of swaying the election toward Donald Trump. That's the new bit of information. Is that something they just figured out, or is that information we're just now hearing about?
Well, this was publicly reported Friday night, but it's something that the lead members of Congress, both parties, and the lead members of the Intelligence Committee in both parties were told about in a secret briefing before the election. Now, what we're hearing, you know, happen today is kind of the war of words, so to speak, among those lawmakers who were in that secret briefing, and now kind of what happened behind closed doors has been leaked out into public view. Now, to be clear, the CIA, you know, made clear that its intelligence suggested this was happening. It also underscored there's a lot of difference of opinion on motivations. Listeners may recall that the FBI has been previously reported as, you know, investigating this issue, but concluding they couldn't tell what Russia's motives were.
Yeah, that makes this tricky. These are, I assume, at least in part, classified investigations, so we don't know exactly what the CIA knows and how they know it. Is that right?
Exactly. And, you know, what we're seeing now is a growing call by Democrats that's actually been endorsed by the Clinton campaign, as we've reported, to get more of this information out there before the Electoral College casts its vote a week from today. Now, that's unlikely to happen because listeners should know that electors, don't have the security clearances or any kind of the background investigations that are required before you can start viewing this sensitive intelligence. But it shows how highly political this got so fast.
Talking to Alana Shore from Politico about allegations of Russian hacking in an effort to sway the U.S. presidential election. So it's significant, it seems like, that we're seeing people like Senator Mitch McConnell, a majority leader there, and now Paul Ryan, it looks like, has signed on the House side of things to saying, yeah, we need some kind of investigation. How important is it that that Republicans are on board here?
It's very important because I think the only way this investigation really gains traction in its conclusion is if it's bipartisan. Of course, it's important to know that some members of Congress are pushing for a completely independent, nonpartisan commission. So if people recall the Simpson-Bowles Commission on the Dead or the 9/11 Commission convened to sort of investigate what went wrong before that disaster, we may yet see multiple bodies investigating this issue.
Can you talk some more? We gave a quote from a tweet or a statement by the Trump transition team. Can you talk more about the response from President-elect Trump and his staff?
Well, President-elect Trump has been clear that he doesn't see evidence that Russia was as involved as the CIA says it may be. And Friday night, his team, although it was an unsigned statement, put out a statement that literally kind of turned the finger back at the CIA and said, it's you guys who told us there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. That alarmed some folks in the intelligence community just because it's kind of widely accepted at this point that it was the George W. Bush administration that kind of selectively edited the CIA's work on that issue. But it really shows how deeply this has gotten under Trump's skin.
And what are we hearing from other people in Trump's team? Reince Priebus has said, the upcoming chief of staff there from Wisconsin, he said he would support investigations to, quote, protect Americans from foreign interference. Mike Pence, vice president-elect, has definitely talked a harder line on Russia than Donald Trump at any point. Are we hearing any internal rumblings from the Trump team on this?
Well, I think if Congress does proceed with what it's likely to do now, this traditional kind of committee-based investigation, the Trump team is going to kind of welcome that and let it move forward, even though it is a bit agitated and perhaps understandably so by this story, because what it does is it kind of saps the president-elect's legitimacy. You know, it gives these critics, these folks who want to upend the Electoral College vote, however long shot, you know, more fodder to make these arguments at a time when Trump would much rather discuss, you know, the government he's trying to build.
You mentioned that it's a long shot that any of this turns around the Electoral College vote. Not many people are expecting anything like that to happen, right?
Pretty much only the 10 people who signed the letter. But no, I joke. Obviously, a lot of folks who really wish Secretary Clinton had won kind of see a glimmer of hope here. But, you know, realistically speaking, there's no chance.
Now, we've mentioned that Donald Trump and his team have been critical of the CIA for this report. How about Donald Trump and his team and the Republicans in Senate and in the House who are calling for this investigation? Are we seeing any public friction there?
Well, you know, so much of Washington is a friction game of inches, right? I mean, certainly the president-elect saying so vocally that he doesn't put too much stock in the CIA's conclusion, being followed by congressional leaders saying they do, suggests that there is some friction. But it's important for listeners to know that, you know, Mr. Trump and his team are not exactly people or creatures of Washington. So in a lot of these cases, they end up depending on congressional leaders, Speaker Ryan, first and foremost, to kind of rein them in when they need to be reined in. And it really will be most interesting to see whether the reining in happens.
What do we know about a timeline on a committee investigation?
You know, Senator John McCain, Armed Services Chairman, has been out front on this since the start, and he's been standing shoulder to shoulder with Democrats on this. So look to him and what he says. And, you know, Senator McCain is often on TV, and he wants to, you know, send this message that we're in control of this and it will not be a quick process. So I would say, you know, months, maybe even more than a year rather than weeks.
And the whole concern over Donald Trump and Russia, this came up during the campaign. And now a Secretary of State, apparently the front runner, Exxon's Rex Tillerson, who people have been pointing out has done business in Russia, has won a Friend of Russia award from the Russian government. Is that raising red flags for people in the Senate who would ultimately have to confirm him?
It is. It is raising major red flags for people in the Senate. You know, it'd be one thing if the Russian cyber intrusions hadn't been an election-long issue and Trump had nominated Tillerson, but it's really, you know, the timing of this likely nomination so soon after the CIA's revelation has come out. I think a lot of senators in both parties are going to be raising some pretty serious questions about whether Mr. Tillerson can separate Exxon's interest, which is inevitably tied to Russia's, from the American interest that he'd have to suddenly start representing.
Alana, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Alana Shore, congressional reporter for Politico. She joined us to talk about how members of Congress are talking about a probe into potential election interference from Russian hackers. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll find out why Wisconsin's obesity rate may actually be higher than we used to think. Right now, we're looking back at the year 2016 through the lens of science. It was a really big year in the world of astronomy. There was the detection of gravitational waves, the discovery of a new exoplanet neighbor, and more. Our friends at Discover Magazine have rounded up the top 100 science stories of 2016, and Bill Andrews joins us now to break down some of the top astronomy stories. He's a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Bill, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much. It's good to be back.
Well, let's start with these gravitational waves. This is a big deal because this is something that Einstein, I guess, had used math to predict. Talk about what he was predicting and why it's such a big deal.
Sure. And I also just say this was a prediction he made in 1916. Mm-hmm. So the fact that we were able to confirm them and come out with this big finding in 2016 is a nice kind of poetic twist on this prediction finally coming true this year. And what he said was that part of his general theory of relativity, which is how he talked about how he described gravity, and things with mass would just warp the space-time around them. Part of that theory suggested that significant enough massive collisions or kind of disturbances in the force, if you will send out ripples in that space-time. That's kind of the fabric of the universe. Everything is made up of this intertwined space-time stuff, and that's what everything is in the universe. And things that are big enough, like black holes colliding or big enough stars running into each other, will send out ripples in this space-time. And that's literally just warps in the fabric of space. It would be kind of the equivalent of the space between you and your computer monitor shrinking and warping, getting a little bigger as that ripple passes through you. Of course, the real ripples are much, much, much tinier than that. They would only warp the distance from Earth to the nearest star, about 25 trillion miles. All that would just get warped by the width of a human hair. So these gravitational waves are pretty tricky to find. That's why it took 100 years.
Right. And gravity, we think of it as this defining force, right? It keeps us, held down on the Earth here. Mm-hmm. But it's actually, as forces go, pretty weak. And this sort of thing, even of two black holes smacking into each other, it's really hard to detect. How hard was this to figure out with the instrumentation we have now?
Well, I guess the quick answer would be extremely. Like I said, it isn't easy to find a gravitational wave, and this comes after decades of searching them out, literally going after them explicitly, and only now being able to finally find evidence of them. It took the work of two twin observatories named LIGO, for Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatories. And basically, they have a kind of a really intricate laser setup to bounce off mirrors, and they have them go down long hallways. And with enough mirrors and enough bouncing, you can kind of get enough distance there where if there is a little ripple, if one of those little waves comes by, it would throw the alignment of that laser off just enough that they'd be able to tell something happened.
Now, we have an audio representation of these gravitational waves. Here's a listen. So pretty subtle stuff there. I don't know. Yeah. That's exactly what you'd hear if you were standing by those lasers. Talk a little more about LIGO. I understand this discovery and future discoveries from LIGO can tell us a lot about stars and black holes in particular.
Yeah, that's what's really exciting about this. So what they found, what the big announcement was this year in February, was evidence of these gravitational waves coming from the merger of two black holes 1.3 billion light years away. So all this distance away, these massive black holes collided, turned two black holes into one black hole, and a lot of extra energy went off in the form of these waves. And 1.3 billion years later, it gets to us, and that's what they found. And that's pretty cool, not just on the physics front, being able to do this and finally being able to satisfy one of Einstein's final predictions, but the idea that now we have a way where we can directly observe black holes. I mean, the thing about black holes is that they're black, and the rest of space is black. They don't reflect light, they don't emit light. It's really tough to be to get any data on black holes directly, and now we finally have a way to do it using gravitational waves. And LIGO is the first to do it, but now it looks like there's going to be more of these types of observatories going up all over the world. There's plans to get one in space that'll be really, really sensitive. I've been saying it's kind of the equivalent of discovering a new color, because now there's a new way that science can look at the heavens. It's a new way of being able to explore what's going out there in a way that doesn't use light. It doesn't use everything else that science has always had. This is an entirely new way to probe and study what's going on out there. So it's really exciting. Definitely our number one story.
This, I was going to say, this is your number one story, not in space science, but in science, period, for the year.
Absolutely. Number one for the year. I would say, I'll go out there and say, for me, this is number one of the decade.
Wow.
Maybe even the century. This is an amazing finding, and I've really been happy about it, just on a personal level. So you can imagine.
Talking to Bill Andrews from Discover Magazine, looking at some of the top astronomy stories of the year. Well, here's another one in our galactic neighborhood, our nearest neighbor. We found another new exoplanet, but this one's really close and maybe potentially in a habitable zone where we wouldn't expect to find it, around a red dwarf. Talk about this Proxima Centauri B.
Yeah, that's right. So
I'm saying that right.
Proxima Centauri B, but yeah, Proxima B is the name of this planet. And yeah, coming in from black holes billions of light years away, now we're coming into our relative neighborhood here. The sun's nearest star is this red dwarf named Proxima Centauri, about 4.2 light years away. So still pretty far away, like I said before, 25 trillion miles, but it's still the closest star that there is to the sun. So the fact that just the closest possible point for there even to possibly be an exoplanet has one, that's already kind of neat. That's a good sign. The fact that it is, as far as they can tell, it might be a rocky planet like Earth, about 1.3 Earth masses, they're thinking. Probably maybe Earth-sized, although they're not sure yet. So, and it is in its star's habitable zone, which means that liquid water could potentially exist on its surface. So already the closest that a planet could possibly be to the solar system, and it's in the habitable zone, it could be like Earth, although we don't know for sure yet, but it's very exciting.
Yeah, in recent years, I mean, there's always been the wonder, like, there's all these stars out there. Are any of them going to have planets, or are we weird and unique here in our solar system? And now that we're figuring out how to look for them, it turns out the galaxy's just lousy with planets. They're all over the place, right?
Yeah, exactly. All over the place. And what's extra exciting about this one is that even though we've been finding exoplanets everywhere, about 3,500 or so at last count, red dwarfs were kind of special because we didn't know if they'd be able to host planets that we'd be really interested in. And red dwarfs are the most abundant type of star in the Milky Way. They're about three-quarters of all the stars out there are red dwarfs. So to find a possibly, maybe Earth-like exoplanet around a red dwarf already tells us, hey, it's looking a lot better out there than we thought it would.
Well, let's find another planet now. We've got eight in our solar system since Pluto was demoted to a dwarf planet. Uh-oh, wait a minute. We might have a ninth. That was one of the other big stories this year. Why do we think we might, after all, have a ninth planet in our solar system?
Well, unfortunately, it all comes down to math. I know that's not always people's favorite subject, but that's what it really is that is saying, you know what, maybe there is another major ninth planet out there that we might be able to add to the solar system's role. And the interesting thing is one of the guys who discovered it, if you will, who predicted it mathematically, is this Caltech astronomer named Mike Brown, who is pretty significant in dethroning Pluto as an official planet. It was Mike Brown's efforts and his research that found all these other planetary-type objects out there that made Pluto less special. And so thanks to Mike Brown, Pluto isn't a major planet anymore. And now, thanks to Mike Brown, we think there might be a ninth planet out there. What he and a co-researcher did was look at some kind of weird orbits of other stuff out in the solar system and say, you know, these rocks, these weird objects are kind of clumping together in their orbits in an unusual way, and it looks like the most straightforward answer to why they're doing that is another planet, another kind of major planet out there, way farther than Pluto, about 10 times Earth's mass. So it's been called kind of a mini Neptune, and now it's all a matter of just pointing the telescopes at the right place and trying to find it.
And that highlights this thing that I love. Once you get out past Pluto, we don't really know what's going on out there. This is a real mystery zone, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And Pluto, if people still feel really bad about Pluto being demoted as a planet, you can take heart because It is the first Kuiper Belt object, which is also pretty special. That's this zone out there beyond Uranus and Neptune, these weird icy, they thought they were kind of dead, you know, they would have to be dead objects with no activity, but when the New Horizons probe went out past Pluto and it saw all this weird stuff on it and activity and glaciation and other stuff, it turns out maybe this zone of the Kuiper Belt objects is a lot more interesting than we thought.
And Pluto looks more interesting, I think, thanks to New Horizons, a hidden ocean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and which, as you can imagine, that's the farthest out former planet. It's no way the sun could heat up anything on its surface. Astronomers didn't think they would find any kind of activity out there. And when I say activity, I don't mean alien activity. I mean, you know, geologic-type activity. But as it turns out, when the New Horizons probe flew past it last year, it saw all kinds of weird, unexpected activity and formations and glaciers and all this weird stuff. And astronomers have been studying all that data nonstop since it went by last year. We're going to be hearing new Pluto information for years to come because it was so much information is coming from that. And, yeah, it turns out that the evidence suggests there is an underground ocean out on Pluto or out in Pluto's surface. And it isn't the kind of a place where we'd necessarily want to take a dip. Of course, it'd be super cold. It's very salty and filled with ammonia and all kinds of other unpleasant chemicals. But the idea that there's kind of a sloshing activity underneath Pluto's surface and that it's slowly freezing as we speak, not that it's been frozen, but it is currently freezing, and that's causing cracks in the surface of Pluto to form, kind of like if you leave a soda can in the freezer for too long. It'll freeze, it'll kind of break out. What's the can? It'll mess it up. That's what's going on Pluto's surface.
All right, all that, plus so there was an ice volcano on Ceres in the asteroid belt, evidence of past tsunamis on Mars. Just in our last few seconds, Bill, what are you looking forward to in 2017 that we might learn next?
I have to say it's just everything is looking so great. I'm hoping maybe for more gravitational waves, more information on Pluto and Ceres and Mars. We've got a lot of fires cooking, and I'm really anxious just to see all the great stuff that comes out of them.
Bill, looking forward to next year along with you then. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That's Bill Andrews, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Joined us with some of the top astronomy news from 2016. You can hear more from the Year in Science next Monday at this time with Gemma Tarlack. Coming up after the news, we'll find out why Wisconsin's obesity rate is higher than we thought it was not that long ago. What's being done about it, too? By the way, thank you to everyone who contributed during our year-end membership drive. More than 2,000 listeners pledged. You donated more than $300,000. Thank you so much. Stick around. More to come on Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, admission fees could go up at Wisconsin state parks. That's one idea in a DNR report to lawmakers laying out options for increasing funding for Wisconsin's parks. First, the state's obesity rate appears to be higher than previously thought. That's according to new data out this month. The earlier estimate was that the obesity rate among adults in the state was 31%, but new numbers from the Survey of the Health of Wisconsin find that nearly 40% of Wisconsin adults are obese. In addition, the state's obesity rate is about 4.5% higher than the national average. However, if you look at the numbers, Wisconsin appears to be falling behind on the obesity fight. So how did we get here? What's being done to turn things around? Dr. Patrick Remington joins us now. He's a professor and associate dean of public health at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Remington, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Well, what accounts for this difference? Previous information had us 9% lower than it looks like we really are.
Well, the big reason is that almost all the previous estimates of rates of overweight and obesity have been gotten by telephone surveys. And we know from recent experience that telephone surveys aren't always perfectly accurate. In fact, people on the telephone tend to underreport their weight, and men especially tend to overreport their height. So when you actually do sampling, which is what the Survey of the Health of Wisconsin does, and go into people's homes and do physical exams, and then also improve the response rates. Make sure you get everybody in the community to agree to participate in this survey. We find that we pretty significantly underestimated the actual measured percent of obesity in the state.
So about 40% of Wisconsin adults obese. That sounds like a lot. That sounds like a problem.
Well, again, it's higher than we expected, and it is a problem because it's related to considerable health care costs, but also just challenges that people have as they gain weight, everything from arthritis to difficulty moving about and higher rates of things like sleep apnea and diabetes. So obviously we want to provide as much help to individuals as we can, but the best thing to do is to provide environments all the way from schools to workplaces to communities that let people be active and eat a healthy diet so that we don't have to be looking at such high numbers in the community.
I want to spend some time on that in a bit, but first, last week we saw new national data out showing that increases in our longevity, our lifespan, have stopped. We're starting to level off, maybe move downward on our life expectancy. Is obesity part of that story?
Yeah, without a doubt. We had actually predicted this, looking at the trends in obesity rates, particularly among younger and middle-aged people. And we knew that as people aged into older ages, as chronic illness becomes more common, that they'd be more likely to get things like diabetes and heart disease and some cancers. And eventually that's going to catch up to you. And so for the first time ever, we've seen a decline in life expectancy. Although it's a very small decline, it really doesn't look good for the future because we haven't, as a population, been able to turn the obesity epidemic around. So I think this will be the beginning of a decline in life expectancy, and obesity rates are continuing to climb with more chronic illness.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at obesity numbers in Wisconsin, higher than the national average, with better sampling, higher than we previously thought. Dr. Remington, I think when a lot of people think about exercise and health, it's an individual story. Someone's having a problem with their weight. They need to eat better and get more exercise. You were starting to touch on this idea earlier, though, that this is a public health problem. There are things we can do on a society-wide basis that can make a better environment for those things. What are some of the first steps you'd like to see?
Well, one of the things we teach here at the School of Medicine and Public Health is that most health problems are a combination of individual behaviors and individual responsibility, but also the importance of the environment that you live in, the type of school you go to, or the type of job you have, or even the neighborhood you live in. And what we like to do is to try and create environments that make the healthy choice the easier choice, the default choice, so that by providing healthy foods in school cafeterias, you don't have to worry about kids eating unhealthy choices. You limit their choices of unhealthy foods, or you provide more palatable, healthy options, kids will eat better. And the same is true in a community that has more healthy restaurants, more places to walk. We know that it's hard, especially in 2016, to live a healthy lifestyle. And so we have to create the environments that make it easier to do than it was as easy as it was to do 20 or 30 years ago.
That makes me wonder, are there differences between communities, maybe high income, low income, or urban, rural, things like that? Are we seeing different obesity trends depending on who we're talking about, where they live?
Well, we are. We see obesity rates vary from community to community. A paper that was published in this Wisconsin Medical Journal looked at obesity rates for women just before they become pregnant. And we found out that about 28% of women are obese at the time they begin their pregnancy, but that rate ranges from as high as 45% in some northern rural counties to as low as 14% in some suburbs of Milwaukee. So a tremendous effect just on where you live on the risk of obesity. And we also see the same thing when you measure the health of the restaurant environment, the healthy foods around you, better in more affluent communities, not as good in poor rural communities, and schools, the same thing with the school environment. We see kids have more active days and better diets in more wealthy schools compared to schools in less affluent communities.
So it sounds like targeting the less affluent communities you just mentioned might be a good place to start. What could happen in those communities at schools and outside of schools?
Well, I think it's important to target every community. There isn't a community that can't improve their environment in schools and in the community itself. We know we all would like to eat better and exercise more, but I think it's particularly important to focus on those communities who are really challenged because of having higher rates of unemployment or schools that aren't performing as well. And I do think, as a sort of a fairness issue, that we should be investing more in the places that have greater challenges in providing environments for kids to grow up healthy.
At the local level, who takes the lead in a public health initiative like that?
Well, that's a great question, Rob. And I think that I would have answered that question differently 30 years ago. I would have said, of course, it's the local health department, and maybe statewide it's the state health department. But what we've discovered, particularly with chronic diseases like obesity and diabetes, is that this isn't a problem that can be solved by traditional governmental public health. It really is a community-wide problem that requires community-wide approaches. So it's the schools, it's healthcare systems, it's employers, it's the not-for-profit voluntary community, it's media like Wisconsin Public Radio that can all pitch in to make a difference. I do think governmental public health has an important convening role, but this is not a problem that can be solved by traditional public health methods.
I've seen in some cities around the country of various sizes, they're taking some of their parks or shorelines or things like that and setting up exercise trails where you walk along and there's a chin-up bar or different types of exercise equipment. This is outside stuff. Is that the kind of initiative that could make a fun community approach to the get more active side of the equation?
Well, there's no question that many communities have discovered that if you build it, they will come. Here in Madison, we have a tremendous network of bike paths. Up in Baraboo, they converted the Baraboo River shoreline from one that was prone to flooding and had dams to now it's a walking path. And every community that has invested in changing the environment so that you make the healthy choice, like walking or getting out and running, the easier choice and the safer choice leads to returns down the road. So, again, it's not easy to do. It's not easy to build sidewalks and build bike paths. It takes an investment from a community, and it takes a lot of support from the people in the community. But without a doubt, creating healthier places to exercise and to recreate leads to better health down the road.
It seems like our society is so biased toward the sedentary now. Our jobs are at desks or sitting in a vehicle, maybe. So much of our entertainment is sitting at a stadium in front of a TV, making angry comments on the internet, whatever our pastime is. Is that a lot of inertia we need to overcome to change ourselves, that we are more active?
Well, it's the lack of inertia, I think, that we have become a sedentary society, and that change. We haven't changed our genetics. We really haven't changed our knowledge about the importance of healthy living. What's changed is the environment, and we've moved from an active lifestyle to now, as you point out, sitting at a laptop with a handheld device, and all the automation that's come into our life to make living easier turns out to make it less healthy. And so we have to design differently so that it overcomes this change in technology that really has created worse health because there are fewer opportunities to exercise. And the other issue is the changing food environment. Food is available everywhere. It tends to be fast, high caloric density. You have to really look around for healthy foods in communities. And unfortunately, when you do find it, it tends to be more expensive. So it is a challenge to be active in every day and also to eat a healthy diet. But so that makes it even more important that we work together on it.
We're talking about obesity in Wisconsin. According to new numbers, obesity rates in the state were higher than originally thought. We have Dr. Patrick Remington from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health with us looking at the causes and possible cures. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Want to hear what's going on in your community. Is there some kind of effort to get kids, maybe even adults, more active? Is healthy food, a lower calorie food, easily, cheaply available where you live? What would you like to see change? What do you think might turn the tide on the obesity rate here in Wisconsin? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our conversation about higher-than-expected obesity rates in Wisconsin, higher also than the national average, and what could be done about that. Our guest is Dr. Patrick Remington, professor and associate dean of public health at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What works and what doesn't in the fight against obesity in Wisconsin? What's going on in your community, maybe at your local schools? Is there some kind of public get out and exercise campaign? Are you in a place where you feel like you can go outside and safely exercise, walk somewhere, bike somewhere? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We talked, Dr. Remington, about what communities can do to encourage getting outside and exercising, more active behavior. How about what communities can do to encourage a healthier eating?
Well, obviously, the first step comes at home. Most food still is consumed at home, so everybody needs to understand what is a healthy diet, that foods aren't necessarily healthier if they're fast. And so processed foods, things where you look at the food label and can't understand all that's in it, is probably less healthy than foods that have a single ingredient. And getting back to really fresh fruits and vegetables, to whole grain breads, to good oils like olive oil and safflower oil instead of lard and animal meat. So it really starts at home. You can learn a lot about this by reading, but also talking to people in your community, also in the healthcare system, about how to eat a healthier diet at home. And then the second place is to think about where we get food in restaurants or outside of home. And we really need to focus on building demand for this type of healthy eating, that simply asking people to close fast food restaurants won't work. This is a place where the market needs to work, where people need to demand healthier foods, and then the market will respond by providing those healthy options.
Let's go to our callers now. Rohini is with us in Brookfield. Rohini, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to talk about?
One of the biggest changes I would like to see, and I'm so glad that this is back in focus, is the presence of communities with parks. We don't live near anywhere where we can walk to a park, and I see new construction as well where builders build homes, but they do not think of incorporating parks, and I think that would go a long way in building community and also developing building healthy habits in kids.
Rohini, thank you so much for that call. And Dr. Remington, that gets back to your point. We need to design our way into better health in some ways, and in this case, parks within walking distance for more of us.
Well, it's a great point. We just met this morning with Professor Jim LeGros from Urban and Regional Planning. And right now, we need to invest in the design of communities thinking about the future. Unfortunately, some of these communities were designed at a time when we thought the automobile would be the best invention ever. And it turns out by eliminating sidewalks and by having dense urban development without walkable places has been bad for health. And so redesigning existing spaces by promoting safe, walkable communities is one approach, but also thinking about investing in the future. And when you go to shop for a home, you can actually, or go to buy a home, you can actually look at the walkability index. It's on nearly every website. And pick a place to live where it has a good walkability index, where you can get to work or shopping or grocery stores by walking right out your front door, as opposed to having to hop in a car and not only pollute the environment, but get less exercise in the process.
Rohini, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Eric in West Bend. Eric, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to? What do you think about this, Eric?
Yeah, I guess for me, you know, the key has really been the diet, and we switched to my wife and I, my family, really a plant-based diet about 3 years ago, and it really transformed our lives. I lost probably 30 pounds within 6 months without exercising. So I really think the key is diet. It needs to be a plant-based, a whole food, you know, natural diet. You have to avoid the processed foods, especially the sodas and the sugary drinks. And once your diet is healthy, you know, the weight falls off, and then all of a sudden you have so much energy, you want to exercise, you know. And so to me, diet is really the key, and avoiding the processed, you know, chemical-laden foods.
Eric, thanks a lot for the call. So a more plant-based diet, he's saying, Dr. Remington, and presumably a non-deep batter-fried vegetable plant-based diet would make a big difference for a lot of us.
There's no question that a plant-based diet is not only healthier for keeping the pounds off, but for overall health. But I think he also makes the point that everybody finds a different way to stay healthy or to lose weight. And for some people, exercise may be exactly what is needed to keep a healthy weight. For other people, dietary changes. I think it makes sense to look at if you've gained a pound a year or a few pounds a year, is to look at it as a long-term process, as a way to make small changes in your diet, exercise just a bit more, and then take the long view that if it took 10 years to gain unwanted pounds, it might take that many years for the pounds to go away. But I would say that it's a combination of a healthy diet, certainly plant-based diet is one, and also adding exercise. Just a little bit more exercise in your day can go a long way.
Thanks a lot for the call, Luke. We're talking to Dr. Patrick Remington from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health about high obesity numbers in Wisconsin. Back to our callers now with Luke in Cross Plains. Luke, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to, you know, say that the ideas that the doctor's putting forward with, you know, how communities can create better access to healthier foods and to exercising, and the idea that, you know, you could choose areas that have walkability, you know, these are solutions that really only apply to maybe 20% of the population, and particularly the areas of the population that are suffering from obesity less. You know, the less affluent communities are the ones that need greater, you know, access to healthier foods, but they just don't have the income to be able to do so, and they're working longer hours, so they don't have the time to be able to put aside time for exercising, or, you know, they rely on fast food because they don't have the time to cook healthy meals. I think that we need to be looking for more comprehensive solutions for these communities, such as, you know, raising income so that they actually have the ability to work less and to purchase healthier foods.
Luke, thanks a lot for the call. So less affluent communities don't have the money for the individual or maybe the community-wide solutions, Dr. Remington.
Well, that's a great point, and I couldn't agree more that solutions begin what we call upstream in social and economic factors, that it is harder to live a healthy lifestyle when you can't afford the healthier food options or you can't afford to live in a safe or healthy community. There are ways, though, to eat healthy on a budget, and those recommendations can be found on the Internet. And there are, I think, nearly every community in the state, including Cross Plains, which I think is debating a bicycle park or a way to open up Black Earth Creek as a safe and inviting place to walk. I think every community can look within and ask what they can do to make this a healthier place for exercising, for getting out and connecting with your neighbors, and then also look for ways to support people who are in greater need, to think about people who might struggle to find the resources to eat a healthy diet, and see if you can solve those problems locally.
Thanks a lot for the call, Dr. Remington. Very briefly, as we wrap up, it seems like we know all the things we need to do. What does it take to make this a reality?
I think two things. One is we heard from a caller who made an individual change that led to a good outcome. And so everybody who's considering this can make small changes and see better outcomes individually. But the other thing is we have to make changes in our communities, in our schools, and that can't be done alone. Teachers are overworked enough and have a hard enough time teaching our kids without having to worry about the school cafeteria and exercise opportunities. So I think come together as a community and try and find those places where you can agree to make communities healthier to live and work and recreate.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Dr. Patrick Remington from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. I've been talking about obesity in Wisconsin. Still time to share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. If you're far from home over the holidays and you're feeling maybe a little homesick, a candle company is hoping they can help you out. They're making homesick candles, one for each state in the union, with smells that represent that state and give you a little scent of nostalgia. So the obvious question on your mind now is, what smells represent Wisconsin? If you're hoping for, say, the smell you get downwind from a fish fry with a bit of yeast and hops thrown in, you are out of luck. According to the product description, a Wisconsin candle, quote, takes you back to the Badger State with scents of Kringle, Wisconsin cranberry, and winter air. Sound good? Well, don't get too excited. It looks like Wisconsin is out of stock. So are all of our neighboring states. The closest I could find would be North Dakota, with hints of mountain spruce, winter air, and the brush of the Great Plains. So the question that pops into my mind is, how do you capture the smell of winter air with a burning candle? It seems kind of like the opposite. Plus, right about now, we're getting plenty of winter air smell in Wisconsin. Just briefly open the door and then slam it shut again, because it's going to get cold over the next few days. Well, hopefully, if you're not in Wisconsin, we're making you nostalgic for the state as you listen online. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.